Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's Monday, October the 22nd, and it's John Dennis here with News Desk. Today, the United States appeals to Turkey to draw back from invading northern Iraq. England licks its wounds after a hat-trick of sporting defeats in football and now rugby and Formula One. And Polish voters deliver a crushing defeat for their right-wing prime minister, turning out in record numbers to elect a new, more liberal government. In Istanbul, thousands rallied to call for war after Kurdish guerrillas killed 17 Turkish soldiers. The Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is in Britain today trying to encourage investment in his country. But the UK, as well as the European Union and the United States, have appealed to Turkey to hold back from invading northern Iraq after last week's vote by the Turkish Parliament. Michael Howard's in Erbil in northern Iraq for The Guardian. He says there's now huge pressure on Mr Erdogan to invade.
There was a major escalation in tensions along the border between Iran, Iraq and Turkey. In fact, most of the fighting between Turkish forces and the guerrillas of the PKK took place on Turkish soil. A group of PKK guerrillas ambushed a Turkish military convoy very close to the Iraqi border. I think something like 17 soldiers were killed, 17 or many more wounded. In response, the Turkish military started shelling villages and towns, areas where they say the Kurdish guerrillas have their bases on the Iraqi side of the border. Although, in fact, the towns and villages that were affected were sort of in the plain. And while the guerrillas generally are reckoned to have their camps high up in the mountains.
What are the prospects now of a Turkish invasion of northern Iraq?
Well, there is intense pressure growing on the government in Ankara to make good on their oft-repeated statements that they will and are prepared to go in. It comes just 4 days after the Turkish Parliament voted overwhelmingly to sanction their generals to go in after the PKK guerrillas. On the other hand, the US and Condoleezza Rice intervened last night and said, please wait, you know, let's treat the situation with cool heads. It is clear that the Turkish military are gung-ho for such an intervention, but many people are warning, including the UN and NATO, that it could be counterproductive. First, it could destabilize one of the safest and most secure areas of Iraq. International aid agencies have warned that another humanitarian catastrophe with displaced people, etc. Iraqi Kurds are also very concerned that Turkish generals will use the pretext of the PKK presence in Iraqi Kurdistan to destroy the autonomy and the stability that they've worked so hard to produce over the last 2 years.
The PKK says it's committed to a ceasefire and a negotiated solution. Do you think that's believable?
The PKK have always said that they are committed to negotiations, that all they are fighting for is Kurdish rights, Kurdish cultural rights, language rights and political rights within Turkey. They have dropped their former insistence on an independent Kurdistan. They are no longer a separatist organization, as many of the Western media continue to call them. But at the same time, they say that they are not going to disarm until the Turkish army stops attacking them and actually opens the way for the group to reintegrate into the Turkish political process. They still maintain that they are in a position of self-defense.
Michael Howard in northern Iraq. Simon Tisdall's a foreign affairs columnist for The Guardian. He told me what had brought Turkey to this point.
Many years of frustration and bloodshed on the border between southeast Turkey and northern Iraq. Basically, there's a long-running insurgency there involving separatist guerrillas who would like to see greater rights for the Kurdish minority in southeast Turkey, or possibly even independence, depending on your point of view, and who are in conflict with the Turkish military and with the Turkish state, which wants to keep the whole area integrated as part of the overall country. Turkey has justifiable grievances in the sense that because Iraq has become such a lawless place, particularly since the invasion in 2003, nothing much has been done to suppress these cross-border incursions and the safe haven that some of these guerrillas have found on Iraqi territory. Secondly, the Americans, who appointed a general, Joseph Ralston, to deal with this issue, have failed actually to crack down either on the PKK or on the support of other Kurdish parties in northern Iraq, illicit or illicit for the PKK. And thirdly, there's an involvement here of the Americans, at least so the Turks say, with Kurdish guerrillas fighting the Iranian army, and that is to say ethnic Kurds who live in Iran, in conflict with the Iranian authorities. And they say, it is said in Ankara by some people anyway, that the American military directly or indirectly has been assisting or turning a blind eye to that activity because it suits their purposes in destabilising Iran.
How might a Turkish invasion affect the wider region?
Well, I don't think we're looking at a major conflict, touch wood when I say that, because there's quite a long history of Turkish military incursions. There are semi-permanent Turkish military bases inside northern Iraq. This is extremely difficult terrain. The Kandal Mountains are pretty impenetrable. It's not a sort of place where you can send tanks rolling across deserts. This is mountain warfare, therefore not necessarily very well suited to conventional forces. Therefore, the Turks' conventional superiority, the advantages of that are somewhat reduced. And we're not talking about very large numbers of people. The Turks talk about 3,000 guerrillas maybe on the Iraqi side. And there also are massive constraints. None of the players wants to see a great conflagration involving Kurds in Syria, Iran, Turkey and Iraq. And the Iraqi government is trying very hard to temper any Turkish actions, as is the US, which hasn't helped its own cause, however, by dabbling with this resolution, dubbing as genocide the Armenian killings of 1915-16.
So do you think the Turkish Prime Minister will bow to calls within his own country to invade, or do you think he'll listen to the warnings of his NATO allies and European neighbours?
I think Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is a quite formidable figure, has been playing a quite cautious game, as has Abdullah Gül, the former foreign minister who I interviewed earlier this year and who is now president of Turkey. They don't want to get into protracted military engagements in northern Iraq. They don't want to upset the Americans. They don't want to have a rupture with Washington, and they don't want to get onto bad terms with the Iraqi government, with whom they have fairly regular talks. But there is an enormous public pressure, especially, again, yesterday after the killing of a dozen troops, and also pressure from the military, which then leads us to the strains between civilian, secular and military governance in Turkey. So it's a fine line that Mr. Erdogan's walking. He has not been best served by some of his allies.
Elsewhere on Guardian Unlimited today, the FTSE 100 index was down by 96.6 points at 10 this morning. That's a fall of 1.5%. Traders say the fall indicated that there are still concerns over the health of the world's economy. You can follow the latest on that at guardian.co.uk/business. On Comment is Free, Michael Tomasky argues that conservative politics in the United States is at a crossroads, and the next election could be disastrous for the Republican Party. On Guardian Unlimited Books today, Dan Glaister reports on a bitter row that's erupted between US publishers of Leo Tolstoy's classic War and Peace. A new edited translation that runs to a mere 886 pages is touted as twice as short, four times as interesting. More peace, less war. And it's been dismissed by its publishing rivals as showing Philistine attitude towards Tolstoy. We'll hear shortly from Simon Burnton from Guardian Unlimited's sports team. But first, Ian Payne is the presenter of our Rugby World Cup podcast. He's with the Guardian's rugby correspondent, Rob Kitson, in a cafe off the Champs-Élysées in Paris.
Given that nobody expected them to get anywhere near 5 or 6 weeks ago, I think the fact that they got there, the fact that they put up the sort of defiant show that they did, the fact that they were within a few inches of going ahead and possibly changing the game, I think they'll be relatively satisfied when the dust has settled, once the disappointment has worn off.
Very interesting comments from Sir Clive Woodward. He's saying, we've papered over the cracks. Maybe this may lull people into a false sense of feeling that there's nothing wrong with English rugby, but he says there still is. What do you think of that?
I think papering over the cracks is a bit strong. I think what we've seen here, that English rugby's rediscovered its heart and soul, in a sense. It's rediscovered the passion. It's been lost for 2 or 3 years, that sort of desire. The domestic calendar has cut across the international one. I think what's happened is concentrated everybody's minds. From where we are now, I think there will be a lot of changes. A lot of that side won't be around forever and ever. There has to be a new wave, if you like. How that's organised is in the remit of Rob Andrew, who's got the top job at Twickenham now. He will have to sit down, assuming that he thinks Brian Ashton has done enough in this tournament to deserve to carry on and be the man to take England forward. I personally think he is. I think he's the best coach available. There might well be a rejigging of the managerial team around him. Just to get new voices in, I think there is a need to move on to a next level. Nobody is saying that this is enough, that English rugby has tapped its potential. There's huge untapped potential at home. A lot of young players, they will come to the fore in the next few years.
South Africa, worthy world champions?
Very much so in my book. I think they had four or five of the best players in their positions in the world. If you've got that in your team, it's a great start, and well done to them.
All right then, well done to them. In our Formula One podcast, Maurice Hamilton spoke to Ian Phillips from the Spyker team. They reflected on how Lewis Hamilton's race was effectively over by the end of the first lap.
Another dramatic race, and the champion is not Lewis Hamilton, not Fernando Alonso, but the outsider Kimi Raikkonen, who took his sixth win of the season for Ferrari to win the world championship by one single point. If nothing else sums up 2007, it is that statistic. Just to remind you, we had a Ferrari, Felipe Massa, the local boy, on pole position. We had Lewis Hamilton alongside him on the front row. Behind Massa was his teammate Kimi Raikkonen, and then behind Lewis Hamilton was the other championship contender, Fernando Alonso. And right from the start, Ian, it looked like Hamilton made a bad getaway. Raikkonen made a good one. They were on the clean side of the track, the two Ferraris. They got ahead, but then Lewis Hamilton got involved in a bit of a tussle with Fernando Alonso and lost out. First sign, I thought, of him getting a bit desperate.
Massa pulled right across in front of Hamilton, so effectively slowing him, allowing Raikkonen to come right round the outside. It was a beautiful piece of teamwork. And while he was being tucked up by the two Ferrari drivers, Alonso, who couldn't care less about his teammate or the Ferrari, thought, right, there's room for me to nip down the inside here. They didn't touch, they got very close, but Alonso won out. And you have to say, probably that was Hamilton's inexperience.
Simon Burnton's here from Guardian Unlimited Sports Desk. Simon, a pretty calamitous week for British sport. We had both the England and Scotland football teams in big trouble now after the Euro 2008 qualifiers, and now second place in the rugby and the Formula One. Have we been expecting too much?
Well, it's certainly been a difficult weekend. There were very high expectations, particularly of Lewis Hamilton. He had been in the lead so long. Just looking at the reaction on our blogs after yesterday's calamitous events, it seems there's a bit of an early backlash against him, that perhaps the golden boy hasn't had such a wonderful season and got his comeuppance in the end.
And what about in the rugby? Do you think that England really had a chance of beating South Africa?
I think that when it comes to rugby, we're a nation of proud but realistic rugby fans. Disappointment, certainly, particularly regarding the disallowed try, but a realisation that we overachieved, really, in getting to the final, and it could have been a lot worse. A month ago, we were looking at humiliation. The average England rugby fan will take what they've got pretty happy right now.
Difficult few days for England's sports fans. What have we got to look forward to next in British sport? Darts, maybe? Snooker?
Well, darts and snooker, certainly Britain does tend to excel in those sports, so that's great. European football returns this week, so we'll be looking forward to perhaps some good home results there. Scotland, Celtic and Rangers have been doing magnificently in Europe, and we'll see if they can continue.
Simon, many thanks. And you can hear our Rugby World Cup podcast and Formula One podcast today at guardian.co.uk/podcasts. Coming up in News Desk, you'll hear how British soldiers prepare themselves for a possible suicide bomb attack or a roadside ambush. And in New York, the finale's in sight for a busking violinist's Bach tour of the world. In elections in Switzerland yesterday, the Nationalist and Anti-Foreigner People's Party won the highest ever number of votes for an individual party. But because of the complex Swiss system, the People's Party won't be a part of the country's ruling coalition. In what's being seen as the most crucial election in Poland since the fall of communism, voters have rejected the nationalist government of the twin Kaczynski brothers. The Prime Minister, Jarosław Kaczynski, conceded defeat last night. Kate Connolly's in Berlin for The Guardian. She says it was a stunning victory for the liberal opposition.
Well, what we've had is the Civic Platform's six-year-old party in Poland has won the election with about 41.6% of the vote. That's around 208 seats in the 460-seat lower house of the Polish Parliament. That's compared to the Law and Justice Party that has been ruled by the Prime Minister Jarosław Kaczynski for the past 15 months. They've come in on just 32%. That's 164 seats in the parliament. So what we're actually going to probably end up with is a Civic Platform led by Donald Tusk, which will go into a coalition with the Peasants' Party, which has secured about 35 seats.
Why do you think voters did so decisively reject Jarosław Kaczynski's moral revolution after only 2 years?
Well, I think this election was extremely important. A lot of polls saw it as the most important election since the fall of communism in 1989. Indeed, this had a bigger turnout, some 53.8% of voters, that was higher than any election since 1989. And I think they saw this election as extremely crucial to changing Poland's image abroad. That was very important for a lot of young Poles in particular, who had basically wanted to reject the social conservatism and isolationism of the Kaczynskis, which they just saw was very damaging to Poland's image abroad and also to the country as a whole.
On a domestic front, will Poland now become more socially liberal?
Well, we need to see about that. We need to wait. Polish politics is a very strange game, very fluid, and the people don't have particular allegiance to specific parties. Donald Tusk, what we've got in him is a leader who has promised to lower taxes. He's talking of wanting less bureaucracy, more privatisation. He says that he now wants to repair relations with the EU, talk about getting Poland back on track in terms of when it might join the euro, and also obviously crucial to Poland at some point in the future is trying to reverse the brain drain, the number of Poles that have left for abroad for work. He needs to try and basically get Poland in shape so that they will be at some point keen to come back.
Kate Connolly. Now let's have a look at today's papers. On the front page of The Guardian, the election that never was cost Labour £1 million. The cash-strapped party, that's Labour, spent five times as much as the Tories on preparations, only to have Gordon Brown cancel the thing at the last minute. The front page of The Times today says that parents of fat children are to be given a warning. The government plans to start getting children weighed in schools, with the parents of obese children sent letters. Parents will also be given advice on calculating how much their children should weigh, but the paper in its leader column says that schools exist to provide an education, and this is invasive government. Also in The Times, a new study in the journal Cancer says that there's no evidence that positive thinking will help if you've got cancer. It may be good advice from doctors to try to remain upbeat, but the cancer doesn't take any notice, it says. In The Telegraph, English pay the price as Scots axe prescription charges, reads the front page headline. It says there's apartheid in public services, with Scotland getting free medicine within 4 years, but patients in England still having to pay for their prescriptions. The Daily Mail front page today, do we have room for 21 million more, it asks, about Britain's booming population. It says today's children will live to see a population in the UK of 81 million. The Independent says an independent inquiry into Britain's laws on asylum has found that the UK has a callous attitude to those claiming asylum. People flee persecution in their own countries and then live in abject poverty, it says, on the streets of our cities. Also in The Independent, Charles Kennedy would return to the Liberal Democrat front bench if Chris Huhne becomes the party's next leader, it reports. But Chris Huhne's support is waning because of a letter he wrote in 1973 supporting liberalisations of Britain's drugs laws. 1973, 34 years ago. It's a bit harsh, isn't it? Daily Express, unsurprisingly, Madeleine McCann is on the front page there. McCann friends face new probe from Portuguese police, it says. Also, free fireworks for every reader. That's a bit dangerous, isn't it? Run for the hills, I say. Daily Mirror, Wills and Harry on bender with England rugby heroes. The Sun also leagues with England's sporting disappointment, but it also carries the news that the X Factor judge Sharon Osbourne quit the show after a row with Danny Minogue. It quotes a source saying that Danny was crying so much she had to have her makeup redone 3 times. And you can read a review of the papers every day by going to guardian.co.uk/wrap and signing up for our daily email. If you're a violinist harbouring ambitions to play the complete works of Bach, and you wanted to help children in poorer countries develop their musical skills, what better way to achieve both ambitions than to tour the world playing Bach? Ed Pilkington reports for The Guardian from New York.
I'm standing with David Juritz just beside the Flatiron Building in central Manhattan. And David has just spent the last 4.5 months travelling some 18,000 miles, busking around the world with his violin, playing Bach to raise money for a charity that he's set up. David, what on earth encouraged you to do this extraordinary thing?
It was inspired, I suppose, by my memories back of my student days when I used to do a lot of busking to earn pocket money and sometimes to pay for holidays. And I remember saying to somebody then, I reckon you could probably busk your way around the world if you put your mind to it. So last year, when the idea occurred to me again, I figured out it was now or never.
Now, in your day job back in London, you're concertmaster at the Mozart Players, a chamber orchestra. What's been the difference in terms of audience?
Yeah, well, you couldn't imagine a bigger change in the world. Back in London, you know, if you're playing to an audience of 1 or 2,000 people and you spot somebody in the concert hall who's fidgeting with their program or something like that, it can be quite distracting as a performer. Yeah, of course, everyone's just wandering by. Most of them are ignoring you. So if out of the 1 or 2,000 people that walk past, one person stops and listens for a bit, that's great, makes your day.
Your journey's taken you through Europe and where else? Where else have you been?
Australia, Singapore, Hong Kong, China, Japan, Buenos Aires, Rio and Caracas, just to name but a few. I think New York is city number 50.
All the way you have raised money for your travels from busking. You haven't spent any of your own money on this?
No. The deal was that I left London with a completely empty wallet, just a fiddle and a backpack to support me. I've had to stand on street corners and earn every penny I've needed for my airfares that way.
And how much have you raised for your charity that you've set up?
Just above £25,000 now, I believe. So we're getting there. We sort of see music quality as a sort of, I don't know if you could call it perhaps a bank for music teachers, except we can't print our own money, unfortunately. What we want to do is help music teachers that want to establish music programs. These programs aren't very expensive to run, but the big cost comes in actually getting them going in the first place, buying the instruments, finding the halls, just setting up the organization. So that's what we're about. We're about helping them get going. It's very easy to feel marginalized in the world when people do wander past and ignore you. It's surprising how much you notice and you feel that. And it struck me when that was happening to me, I thought, well, there must be a lot of kids who actually feel they've got a lot to offer and they want to be included. They want to actually have opportunities and they want to do things, contribute with their lives, but they don't get the chance because they come from the wrong place, they don't look right, or people just see them as a possible threat, so they blank them out.
So you're going to be nicer to buskers on the London Underground in future?
Oh, well, you know something, I've always had a slightly soft spot for buskers. I think it's important that you're good if you busk. There's no excuse for bad playing, but I find it very hard to walk past a good busker without putting something in their case.
The British Army has acquired new equipment that simulates a suicide bomb attack. The Guardian's Stephen Morris has been to Salisbury Plain to see how it works and what ordinary soldiers make of it.
Welcome to Copal Down. Welcome to the Land Warfare Centre, and welcome from me.
The briefing is taking place in a fake church in a mocked-up village high on Salisbury Plain to show off two new bits of kit designed to prepare soldiers for terrifying modern-day scenarios they may encounter: a suicide vest simulator and a device that imitates the effect of a roadside bomb. During the briefing, a man has been jostling reporters. Frankly, we thought he was another sharp-elbowed cameraman, but he takes off his sports jacket and reveals that he is wearing what appears to be a suicide vest.
One of the most difficult threats to counter, and no one sort of thought, who's that then and what is this up to? And here is our suicide bomber. Right? Now, the system is perfectly safe to use and he could explode. It stood where he is now and it won't do any damage to anybody.
White powder to replicate smoke pours from the vest as it explodes. Then we're taken outside onto Copal Down Village's main square. A warrior armoured vehicle hurtles in and screams to a halt outside a row of pretend houses as a loud explosion shakes the buildings. Real smoke billows from the make-believe roadside bomb and the troops open fire.
Today we've been looking at the simulation equipment we use for live training. Most aspects of that system we've been using for some years, but as the threat against us in various theatres has evolved, we have been looking at ways of better replicating those threats in the scenarios that we train our soldiers in. We recognise that there will always be, as well as a conventional enemy threat, there will always be the threat from insurgent groupings, and of course there will always be a densely populated battlefield, i.e. there will always be civilians around. And so we try to replicate that better in our training now. Most of the time, we are training in a generic nature, We would then, at the end of that training, when we've got to a high degree of proficiency in our generic warfighting skills, we would then take troops and give them specific pre-deployment training, which is geared towards the theatre they're going to. And currently that would probably be Iraq or Afghanistan. And at that point, we can even more closely tailor the scenarios to include cultural awareness training and trying to make this really match the sort of threat they will face in the theatre.
Private David Middlemiss, you've been out in Iraq. I guess lots of people would think, how can you replicate what goes on in Iraq with what goes on in Salisbury Plain?
You do learn a lot, because you realise how close a suicide bomber can actually get to you before detonating.
And I guess for the guys who haven't actually been out there, this is invaluable.
Very valuable for them. It's a good learning curve because they understand how to look for an IED and how to look for a suicide bomber and to see actually what sort of things go on out there.
Stephen Morris reporting. Today's edition of News Desk was produced by Phil Maynard and Ian Chambers. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.